I wanted to talk today about some just very basic things we've been doing to look at the origins of variability, phenotypic variability in cell populations. And this work started actually in Arnie's lab. And it was basically trying to ask the question about where differences between cells in a population come from. And of course, if you have, in general, a set of organisms, there can be lots of different reasons they might be different from each other. So very general terms. First of all, they can be genetically different. All of us in this room have different genes. They can be living in different environments. They can have experienced over time different histories. They could have, for a while, been living in one environment and switched to another. And they could remember those differences in their history. And so all of those things are kinds of variation that you can control. So we can remove genetic variation by growing isogenic populations. We can remove environmental variation by growing things in a completely homogeneous uniform environment if we so choose. And we can even get rid of the issues about the cell history, because we can take cells that have all grown up from a single cell and keep them in the same environment over time. So they'll have exactly the same history. And the basic observation is that even when you remove genetic variation, environmental variation, and this kind of cell history variation, you still find that different cells in the population look different from each other in various ways. And so a basic question is where that variation is coming from. And the particular origin for that variation that I'm going to focus on today is stochasticity. So it's non-deterministic effects within the biochemical networks of the cell. And we're going to try and ask, in the first part, the talk has actually two parts. In the first part, I'm going to try and ask the question whether these stochastic effects really are significant for cells. And, you know, if so, how much of a cell's behavior is really unpredictable? We're going to ask this question with respect to gene expression in particular. And in the second part of the talk, I want to discuss some newer work where we're looking at the dynamics of this stochasticity of noise and at how it combines with gene regulation to give you the effective behavior of the cell. Okay, so in the idea that stochastic, the just basic stochasticity of the reactions, the chemical reactions inside a cell could give you some kind of phenotypic randomness, it goes back a long way. And I think it can be seen really easily in a very simple example where you imagine that there's some species X that's created and destroyed at constant rates. And if this were just continuous differential equations, you would expect this thing to go exponentially to a steady state of K over D. In this example, I chose K over D to be about 40. And you can just see here, of course, what you would expect, which is that if you simulate these things in a Monte Carlo style way, you can get significant variations over time just because of the randomness of the discreteness of the molecules and the timing of the reaction events, which are basically stochastic processes. That's all. And this was pointed out in the 90s by McAdams and Arkin, who took this basic premise and applied it to a model, simple model of gene expression, and showed that gene expression might be expected under reasonable conditions to be quite random. Okay. And then what they did is they went a step further and they said, well, if we make a model of a developmental process, in this case they chose just the lysis-lysogeny decision of the bacteriophage lambda, which is a decision when it infects a cell about whether it should lie dormant in the chromosome or whether it should kill the cell and make many copies of itself. They did simulations of a rather large network of interactions that they felt that they gathered from the literature, and basically could interpret the outcome of this decision in terms of the stochasticity of the reactions goes on. So in other words, for the same initial condition, you could get two different outcomes, lysis or lysogeny. There's no difference in the cell beforehand, no difference in the phage beforehand, simply the stochasticity in the reactions. The problem with this is basically a simulation, and we don't really know what the effective reactions are inside the cell. We don't know what the parameters are. We don't know how much variability there is before the phage infects the cell and so on. So this just shows that it's possible that stochastic effects could actually influence developmental decisions in a real system. And here's an example from some more recent work we've been doing, which I think really shows very directly the kind of variability I'm talking about, just to make it seem very real. This is going to be a movie of cells of Bacillus subtilis, which is a soil bacteria that form spores. The spores are kind of similar to anthrax spores. And all I want to show in this movie is that here we have genetically identical cells growing in a pretty uniform environment. And what you'll see is that over time, they'll start to make spores. But the decision about whether to make it and when to make it varies a lot from cell to cell. So here they're growing over time. And you'll start to see spores popping up. These are these white, bright spots. You'll see that some cells make the spores early, some later, and some don't make it at all and then die. Some begin to make it and die. So this kind of stuff over here is just dying cells. And at the end, you have some cells who have survived and some cells that have died. And the point is that the environment here is pretty uniform. There's a lot of cell-cell signaling going on, which complicates the issue a little bit. But nevertheless, you have variability that's being generated in the system from scratch. So. Yeah, so it could possibly be, actually, there's this cannibalism idea in this system that the cells themselves are making antibiotics that are killing other cells. So in that sense, there's a whole intercellular dimension that's quite interesting. Yeah. I think in these conditions, not. Non-spores survive. I think at the end point, after like 4 days of this movie, you pretty much have spores and death all around them. But there's other conditions where you can get other. Actually, the interesting thing about this system, the reason we've been working on it, is because under you can find one set of conditions where you can get a whole bunch of different outcomes. So here I'm only showing sporulation, but in fact there's a whole variety of stress responses, and we can actually see different cells doing very different things at the same time. So in the first part of the talk, I wanted to concentrate on this, just the question of gene expression as a particular phenotype. And where does this variability arise? Here's an example of E. coli expressing GFP, green fluorescent protein. And you can see that some cells are very bright and some are dimmer. And this is exactly the sort of thing we'd like to understand. Why is it that some are bright and some are dim? Okay, and so the first question we have to ask is how we would even know if things really were stochastic inside the cell. The problem is that if you take two different cells, they could be different either because there's something stochastic going on inside them, or they were different before, and you're just amplifying pre-existing differences. How can we distinguish between those two possibilities? And the idea is that there's an ideal thing you'd like to do, which is that to say that if something is non-deterministic, what that means is that if you take two copies of it and put them in this exact same initial condition and wait a while, over time, they will become different. And if they're deterministic, they will stay the same as each other. So you'd like to take two exactly identical cells in which every molecule is in exactly the same place and so on, and you'd like to put them in exactly the same environment, wait a while, and ask the question, are they still the same? Okay. Now, the problem with this is you can't do this experiment. And the reason you can't do it is because even if we take two sister cells that have just divided from each other, there's already big differences between them. Those can be systematic, because you can have proteins, for example, localized to one pole that gets segregated out to one side, or they could be stochastic. But we see it in these movies and in many examples that even two sister cells are very different. So the problem is that we can't really do this experiment. We can't prepare two cells in an identical state. And so instead of preparing two cells in an identical state, put them in an identical environment, the idea was to take two identical genes and put them in the same cell. And here, the identical genes are not perfectly identical. They're actually slightly different colors of green fluorescent protein. So we have one that's called CFP, one that's called YFP. And in this talk, I make them green and red. And the idea was to take exactly the same, almost exactly the same gene sequence, same regulatory sequences around it, put them in the exact same cell, and then just ask the question whether their expression is correlated or uncorrelated. Because if everything's operating deterministically, these two genes ought to look the same to the cell. And so they ought to be correlated over time in their expression. And if you looked at a population of cells, you would expect that they would all make exactly the same amount of green and red, which is to say they'd all be yellow, although the amount of yellow might vary from cell to cell. And in the other extreme, you can imagine that the expression of these two genes is uncorrelated. And that's if all the variation is coming from independent stochastic processes going on at the two alleles. And in that case, you might, by chance, expect some yellow cells, but you'd also get some that are more red and some that are more green. So these are the two extreme possibilities that you can get. And you can see that this corresponds to this extreme stochastic limit, and this corresponds to an extreme deterministic limit. So imagine possibilities in between. So the reason we did this is because we felt that this was kind of the operational definition of what it meant for variation to be beyond the control of the cell. And the way we decided to look at this in E. coli was by taking the E. coli chromosome, which is a circular DNA molecule, putting a CFP gene at one side, a YFP gene at the other side, under exactly the same promoters, and doing this and then measuring the expression of each of these two genes. And we put them at approximately equally distant from the origin of replication, which is this ORIS-C locus right here. And the reason for that was because DNA replication in E. coli proceeds outward from this origin of replication. And so the copy number of a particular gene at any particular time depends on where it's located on a chromosome, which is a little bit different than the situation in eukaryotic cells. And we did this with a variety of different promoters also. Yep. How different are what? Oh, so actually they only differ by a few point mutations that change the color. So there's like one in the chromophore and a couple in other locations. So extremely similar. Okay, and then we use fluorescence microscopy. So here's a phase contrast image of cells. Here's those same cells in the CFP channel. And here's the same cells in the YFP channel. And if you go back and forth, you can see that some cells are brighter in one channel and some are brighter in the other channel. And then you can make pictures like that by superimposing them. When we really do the experiment, we put them down at lower density so they're easier to quantitate. We have a computer program that automatically identifies the cells. And then we can actually get fluorescence per cell. And here what I wanted to show actually is a control that is actually necessary for this whole approach to work. And so the assumption here is that the two genes are really reporting on exactly the same stochastic process. So how do you know that that's true? Well, what we can do is we can grow cells in a variety of conditions so that we express these promoters to different levels. And then we can plot a histogram of how much CFP and YFP expression we have over these conditions. So these are actually three superimposed histograms with a variety of conditions. And what you can see is that over two orders of magnitude in the expression level, the detailed distribution, the CFP and the YFP is the same. All we've really done is rescale the YFP by a constant factor over this whole range, and that's because the units of these numbers that come out are really the units of your CCD camera. They have nothing to do with anything real. So we've just rescaled them by one constant factor over this range, and the nice thing is that you can pretty much superimpose these histograms. And I should say that the first few times we did this experiment, this was not true. So this was not satisfied in the early versions of these strains, and so we had to actually change things around to make this true. I think what turned out to be really the problem was that in some conditions we're getting probably expression from promoters outside of the region on one of the target loci in which we inserted things. So under other conditions, you don't get that, and everything works out fine. Yes. So you could imagine that, or you could imagine, for example, methylation in E. coli. You can also have that, and that can control on a long time scale the state of expression of a promoter. All of those things could, in principle, happen, and if they did, they would mess this up. So we're not saying that they don't happen. We're just saying that for these conditions, they're probably not happening. And I'll show you later in the talk, we actually have the dynamics, so we can say the time scale at which gene expression is varying, and it's pretty fast. So if it was kind of slow epigenetic effects, we would see that. They could be, but here they would have to be correlate. I mean, they're not. Well, they'd have to be the same on average on both loci. That's what we're saying. We're not saying that they're not happening. It's just actually to distinguish there's a few different experiments kind of all combined here in these graphs. So the dashed lines is just one set, this solid line is another set, and the other solid line is a third set. Yeah, this doesn't really mean anything. This graph's a little confusing. It's basically as we grew them in different levels of induction and then mixed them together. And actually, we mixed them together in several batches. So. Yeah. Yeah, but they pass a coma. Yeah. Wait, where? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these might not look identical because of the binning, for one thing, which would not be meaningful. If you look at a cumulative histogram and you do like a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test on the cumulative histogram, then they pass that test as being, you can't say that they come from different distributions. Right? That's what we mean. Statistically, they are consistent with coming from the same distribution. That's the statement. Well, first of all, no, both colors are in the same cell.
Yeah.
And then we're specifically interested in a case where, on average, both colors behave the same. That's what this graph is supposed to show. Yeah. Well, that's much easier to interpret than a case where they're just under different regulatory control. So the normal thing is that every gene is controlled a little bit differently. And then, if you see that that one is behaving differently than the other one, it's perfectly possible that's because it's being regulated differently, right? And that wouldn't be attributable to stochastic effects. That would be attributable to differential regulation of two different genes, which goes on all the time. Well, I'm saying if the promoter sequence is different and they bind to different transcription factors, it's to be expected that they'll be turned on and off at different times depending on what transcription factors are being expressed. So that's the normal case, and that's, of course, what we're really interested in, is understanding when you have a complex network with lots of different promoters that are differentially regulated by different combinations of transcription factors, what's going on. And this is kind of a baby problem to say, well, if we have a much simpler case of just the same promoter, how much variation do we get just from that case? And then what we want to do is be able to go up to these much more complicated promoters that have many inputs Okay. So if we want to interpret this data, the idea is we could plot each cell as a dot on a graph where we have on the x-axis the amount of CFP and on the y-axis the amount of YFP. And the idea is that the shape of this cloud of points is going to tell us something about where noise is coming from. So if you imagine that there was no stochasticity inside the cell, everything was behaving totally deterministically, then all these points would lie exactly along a diagonal line. And so the variation away, the RMS deviation from the diagonal line, is a measure of what we call intrinsic noise. So this is the noise you get. This is basically a measure of how stochastic gene expression reactions are. But you can see that this cloud of points is stretched out along the diagonal as well. It's a little stretched out more along the diagonal than it is perpendicular to the diagonal. And so there's some correlation. And so that extra variation, that extra correlated variation, we're going to call extrinsic noise. And the idea is that these two kinds of noise have direct physical interpretation. So intrinsic noise affects two identical genes differently, independently, whereas extrinsic noise affects two identical genes similarly. And the interpretation is that anything that goes on at a specific copy of the gene, so binding of a polymerase, binding of a ribosome, etc., those are reactions that are basically intrinsic to the process of gene expression, transcription, translation, and so on. Whereas things that go on upstream of these genes, so variations in level of a transcription factor, variation in the amount of polymerases, ribosomes, et cetera, or things in the microenvironment of the cell, all those variations are extrinsic to the process of gene expression. And so these words intrinsic and extrinsic we're defining them very specifically with respect to the process of expression from a particular gene. You can also think of intrinsic and extrinsic in other terms, and there's been some discussion in some about what the correct definition of intrinsic and extrinsic ought to be. But, yeah.
So the noise is connected around the line.
Yeah. It actually is. Yeah. Okay. And the idea is that with these definitions, intrinsic and extrinsic is always specific to a gene, and noise, and they can propagate through a network. So if you imagine that there's some transcription factor regulating another gene, then the idea is that intrinsic noise in the expression of A can create variability, which would show up as extrinsic noise in the expression of B, and B in addition has its own intrinsic noise. So the idea is that in a cascade, intrinsic noise can show up as extrinsic noise in the next gene, and noise can propagate through a genetic circuit. And that's an issue we're also interested in. Okay, so I just want to show you quickly what the data looks like. The interesting thing is you can have regimes in which noise, intrinsic noise is important and regimes where it's not so important. So if you take very strong phage promoters that come from viruses and are just turned on at full strength, they tend to give you actually not very noisy expression at all. So this is very uniform. The amount of variation from cell to cell is only on the order of 6% or so. However, if you go down to more typical regimes, more typical levels of expression, then you start to see colors showing up. And so here what we have is 30-fold less expression in this picture, and you see that the intrinsic noise goes way up to like 25%. So the idea is that just the level of expression is going to control how noisy things are, and that's consistent with the simplest model of gene expression, which is just that mRNAs are produced in a Poisson-like fashion. And so the higher the average rate of expression, it's like shot noise, the lower the noise. So that also changes, and so you can see in these numbers intrinsic and extrinsic, as I've defined it before. And if you wanted to get the total, what we call the total noise, which would be if you only had one color, how much variation there would be from cell to cell, like the standard deviation divided by the mean, you would take the square root of the sum of these two guys. So we define that the square of the intrinsic and the square of the extrinsic add up to the square of the what we call the total, which is just the cell-cell variation. Okay. So it would be, you know, on this order. What is what? No, the idea is that they're two independent components.
They are, okay.
Yeah.
Go
back
then.
Yeah.
Obviously,
forward. Right, in a particular, yeah. So the idea is intrinsic noise in one gene will show up as extrinsic noise in another gene. So when you think in terms of the circuit, you have to follow the propagation of noise through the circuit. Yeah, that's right. But we can still define them as independent components at the in the expression of a particular gene that we're looking at. And that's what we do. And in fact, yeah. Not the system. So when you talk about the system as a whole, then there's other techniques to kind of trace the propagation of noise. Yeah. Yes. So here, actually this graph does not show that. In this graph you can see that the extrinsic is green, intrinsic is red. If we go down to low expression, they become about equal. But there's other conditions we've had in which the intrinsic can actually, at low expression, be the dominant source of variation. Here, they're about comparable, and then you can go to a regime where the extrinsic is dominant in this particular case. Okay. But that, yeah. Not divided by the mean?
No, not divided by the mean. The actual structure. The actual standard
structure. So the absolute level of expression, if you normalize this to be 1, then this is
0.03.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. You're saying is the problem that the mean's going down, or is it that the fluctuations are going up? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. I'm wondering if your mean of intensity is going down.
Yes.
But the absolute fluctuation
rather than
constant.
So we should be able to calculate that from these numbers, actually. That's right. Yeah, that's right. It actually works out. Like you can see it really better, I think, in this graph, where this is the intrinsic noise with our normalization. And this starts out going down like 1 over the square root of the expression level. This is a log scale on the x-axis. And at the end, it almost goes down like 1 over square root of expression level, except for at the end, it doesn't go to 0. And the reason it doesn't go to zero probably has is partly to do with measurement errors. So we can't actually measure a zero here. And it could also have to do with things like DNA replication, which can also be stochastic. And would you expect to give you a constant, even at infinitely high expression level. The other interesting thing in this graph is that if you look at the extrinsic noise points, you can see that they go up and then go down again. So they had this curious behavior. And we were wondering what that came from. And the explanation that we came up with really has to do with the way in which we built this system. And the fact is that even though we think we're looking just at these two promoters, of course, we're actually seeing things that are upstream of the regulation of the promoters that we think we're looking at. So for example, what we've really done here is we have LAC repressor, which is a very well-known repressor gene in bacteria, turning off the expression of these two things. And in order to vary the amount of induction of these two genes, we're adding different amounts of IPTG, which is shown here, this chemical. Okay, now the point is that LAC is also a gene, and it's also going to be variable. It also has its own noise, right? And so the level of basically, as you increase the level of IPTG, you're coupling more and more and then less and less to the existing variation in LAC I. So the idea is that you have some distribution of LAC I per cell from its own intrinsic and extrinsic noise. And you can think of three regimes, low IPTG, medium IPTG, and high IPTG. So at low IPTG, we're going to have very little expression of our test genes. And so the intrinsic noise will be high, but everybody will pretty much be off. So that all the cells will be in more or less the same state. And so the extrinsic noise will be low. Now, when you go up to very high IPTG, now because the expression level is high, there's not much intrinsic noise in the expression. And also, all the cells are pretty much fully induced. So they're all very similar to each other. And so the extrinsic noise is also going to be low as well. But the idea is that at intermediate levels, suddenly you have some cells that have more LAC I than IPTG and some cells that have more IPTG than LAC I. And all of a sudden, cells can be very different from each other. Some can be very bright and some can be very dim. And so here you have a medium level of intrinsic noise because you have a medium average level of expression, but you actually have a high extrinsic noise. And the idea is that we're actually seeing variation in one level up of the cascade that we're looking at. Okay. And of course, everything I showed you so far was with one particular promoter, but things could be very different for different promoters, and there's obviously many different promoters you could look at. Here we took a totally different promoter, and this red dashed line is the intrinsic noise that from the previous graph with our first set of promoters. But these red points now are measured for this other promoter. And you can see that they're actually consistent with it. And so it means that for two basically unrelated promoters, the intrinsic noise curves are the same and only depend on expression level, which is nice. This doesn't, of course, mean that for every promoter this will be true. So we started using this word, tuniversality, to apply to things that we have two examples that are consistent with each other. Okay. Now, the other thing we wanted to know is what about the interaction between the genetics and this kind of phenotypic noise? And in the process of looking at different strains that had these noise promoters in them, we found some that were much noisier. And these were produced by deleting a RECA gene. So the idea is that we actually have a mutation that affects the amount of the noise phenotype. So you can think about actually doing the genetics of noise. And this gene that we actually just discovered by chance, RECA has many phenotypes in the cell when you mutate it. It's involved in recombination, it's involved in DNA repair, and so on. And so these cells are also very sick. But nevertheless, it's kind of a way in which mutation of the genome can actually control noise. And here's just a movie to show you how sick they are. If you look at these guys here, they're going to jump up here. And this is how we knew we had to kind of worry about this a little bit, because you can see the noise, like green cells and red cells in the same population. But you can see that this colony just gets stuck and more or less is dead while cells all around it are growing happily. And so in order to define the noise for these cells, we actually had to go back later and decide whether they had been able to grow up into big microcolonies or not, to decide whether they were really truly alive at the time we did the measurement. Okay. And even if you do that, yeah. Yeah, we tried to do that experiment, and the problem was that the YFP we were using at the time was really sensitive to P53 pH to other things. And we were getting this thing where the YFP was, in stationary phase was going off, but not the CFP. So we were violating that condition with the histograms. So we weren't able to really to. Anyway, so the hypothesis as to what's going on is that in these REC-A cells, you can't repair damage to the DNA, and so you get kind of chromosomal instability where one side of the chromosome can get replicated and produce extra copies of the gene and the other one gets stuck for a while. It's known that in the absence of REC-A, these DNA damage can take hours to repair, if at all. And that explains also why cells are so sick. No, because there's a termination region at the bottom. They don't. It doesn't go in a rolling circle. It actually goes one way and then terminates at the bottom. Okay, so this is a very similar experiment was also done by Aaron O'Shea, who's here. And they did it in yeast. And here, actually, they took advantage of the fact that it's, in some ways, a much more natural system in yeast, because if you take diploid yeast cells, then every gene is present in two copies anyway. And so the idea that you could have two different alleles of the same gene that would normally be regulated identically is a really natural way of thinking about this experiment. And so they put CFP and YFP in exactly the same locus in a diploid organ cell. And again, they could see it both intrinsic and extrinsic, but they found that this extrinsic component is dominant. In other words, most of the variation was coming from things upstream of the actual process of gene expression. And they also found mutations, both cis and transacting, that were able to affect the amplitude of noise as well. Hope that's okay. The other thing that I actually thought was worth measuring is that this idea of as a way of looking at noise, looking at internally two different measures of the same process in the same context, is very old. And in the context of development, there's this idea of fluctuating asymmetry, which has been used to measure developmental noise for a long time. And so here you take a bilaterally symmetric organism that has two things that should be produced by the same process, for example, two ears generated by the same network. And if you measure differences that are not systematic, so it's not that the right ear is always bigger, but random fluctuations from organism to organism in the relative size of the two ears, then you get a measurement in a way of how important noise is in developmental processes. And there's a big literature on fluctuating asymmetry, which is tries to connect it to everything from mate's choice to inbreeding to all sorts of things. And it's a little hard to tell how much of it is to be taken seriously, but it's kind of interesting. In terms of what? There's lots and lots and lots of measurements, but some of the conclusions are kind of hard to believe. For example, I think women are supposed to choose male mates according to lower fluctuating asymmetry, but men do not prefer lower fluctuating asymmetry in women. I saw that, for example, in one paper. I don't know. So twins is, of course, a whole other. You mean just identical twins versus non-identical? Yeah, that's a whole huge other literature of human genetics. Yeah. But I think this fluctuating asymmetry really gets the same spirit as our experiments, because it's really the same idea. You put two independent but identical processes in the same organism. Well, you have to imagine that the environment of your left ear is somehow systematically different than the environment of your. Oh, is it? Okay, so now I wanted to switch to the second half, in which we talk. So everything I told you so far really is basically done at steady state, where we're just taking snapshots of populations of cells as they are. Okay. And this whole picture has neglected so far anything about the dynamics and also anything about how you put gene regulation into this picture. So just imagine, more from almost everything I've said, that there's some steady state level of expression and we're just looking at how noisy that is. So we want to ask what happens when we add dynamics and regulation to this picture. And the general problem we have in biology is to understand, if I give you a gene and I tell you that its promoter binds to a bunch of different transcription factors, A, B, C, and so on, I want to know something about both how the expression of the gene depends on the concentrations and states of those transcription factors in general, and also how the noise of this gene is going to depend on the noise and the levels of these transcription factors. So this is called the sort of cis-regulatory problem. And in higher organisms, multicellular organisms, this is an even bigger problem because there's, you know, many, many, many transcription factors controlling the gene. Yeah. That's true. So we did talk a little bit about the regulation there, but all the snapshots were taken at sort of steady state conditions. So we weren't varying things over time. So. Okay. So we decided, of course, to start with the simplest possible example, which is just a single transcription factor, in this case a repressor, turning off the expression of a single gene, and just ask what we could learn in this very, very simple case. And the perspective we took is that when we write down models of gene regulation networks, one does whenever one's trying to basically make a model of a natural network or to design a synthetic gene expression network, which more and more people are doing now, you always come up with some function like this, which we call the gene regulation function. And this is a function that tells you how much of your target gene you're going to produce as a function of how much of the different repressor or other transcription factors you have present in the cell. And we always imagine that this function looks something like this. It's some monotonic function. We imagine that it has some, maybe it's very nonlinear, maybe it's not very nonlinear. But in every case when we're trying to model a network, we always have to write down something like this, and we never really know what it looks like. So we decided to ask whether we could actually measure what this looks like at the single cell level. Okay. And in particular, now that we know that noise is so significant, it raised the direct question, which was, if we know noise is so important inside the cell, is such a function even well-defined? Like, are we really, is it really legitimate to write down a model that incorporates a production term that looks like this? So is this gene regulation function well-defined at the single cell level? And the way in which we went about looking at it was, again, with these CFP and YFP fluorescent proteins. In this case, we built a simple cascade of two repressors, where the first one turns off the second one, and the second one turns off the third one. Here, the second one is a fusion protein, so it's a chimeric protein which has a domain of lambda repressor fused to a domain of YFP, so we can see it in the cell, and it's turning off a target gene, which is CFP, which we can also see. And so what we really want to be able to do is simultaneously measure the production rate of the target gene and the amount of repressor in the same cell at the same time, and that's shown here. Okay, and the idea of the experiment was, actually, in order to do this, we really need to be able to change the repressor concentration over time in the same cell. And it turns out that that's a little bit hard to do while observing the cell. And what we decided to do instead was to take advantage of the natural process of dilution during growth as a way of taking logarithmic steps, twofold, 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 in order to vary the amount of repressor we have in the cell. And so the idea is that before the experiment starts, we're going to give a pulse of expression of this repressor, C1YFP, and let it dilute out over time. And so this is a log scale here, schematically. We imagine a staircase of twofold steps every time the cell divides in half in the repressor. And we imagine that the target gene CFP also will take twofold steps. This is on a linear scale, twofold steps down until there's sufficiently little repressor that you can start to express this thing. And then as the repressor level continues to go down, the slope of this CFP line will increase. And so what we want to know is the slope of this green line versus the amount of the red line, right? Because the slope here is the rate of production of the target gene, which is the y-axis of our gene regulation function. And the x-axis is this, the amount of this red line, the amount of repressor. Well, the idea is the promoter is turned off because there's lots of repressor. And so it's just being diluted out. The cell grows and divides, and half goes to each cell. So it's just dilution. It's very simple, actually. And this is what it looks like if you really do it. This is the repressor in red being diluted out during growth in a microcolony. You can see the red repressor getting diluted out, and then you can start to see the green target gene turning on. And so that's the experiment, basically. We do that for different conditions and so on. Actually, the repressor tends to, because it's a DNA binding protein, it tends to stick to the nucleoid. So bacteria don't have a nucleus, but they do have kind of a region in the center where the chromosome is. And especially if you overexpress this repressor, you can really see it sticking to the nucleoid. If you really overexpress it, in fact, it seems to glue the nucleoid together, and the cell division gets all messed up. So. Okay. Okay. So in order to do this, we actually, over the last couple of years, have been building a whole bunch of image analysis tools which allow us to actually segregate the individual cells in these microcolonies into different cells. Here the colors are just labels, and to track them over time. So we can take a movie like this and can reconstruct the whole family tree of the microcolony. So this is the first cell, divides into two cells, and so on over time. And when you see these cell lineages stop, it's mainly because we just stopped following those cells. Either they went underneath a big pile of other cells, or for various reasons, we occasionally truncate the lineages. It's not because the cells are dying. But otherwise, we get plenty of data at the end, and we can really follow the dynamics over time in these colonies. And you can use that tree, actually, to spit out a movie of any particular cell lineage you want. But here's just one lineage. You can see one cell growing, dividing, and turning on. And we can do this, of course, for any cell. Okay. And then this is what the actual data looks like when you do this. So it looks a lot like the schematic I showed you before. This is, again, a log scale in red. And you can see these twofold steps down to the staircase of repressor concentrations. Here, the dark curve is one particular lineage, and the curves behind it are the other lineages in the same microcolony. And here, the green is the target gene. And you can see that at first it's flat here. It's diluted out a little bit. And then it starts to slope up a little bit, and this is now on a linear scale. So you can see that the slope here does, in fact, depend on the amount of repressor. Yeah. The dark curves are one lineage, and then all the other lineages are in the light curves. Yeah. Well, so this depends a little on our judgment of when it divided. So our computer program makes a decision based on the, you know, kind of invagination of the edge of the cell. It's a little bit arbitrary to decide exactly when the division is. So that it's sometimes not very easy, even if you look at it by eye, to say, is it divided now or not? You know. So there's some error in interpreting when exactly the division event occurs.
That's right.
Yeah. 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 Right. You see that here. Like every time you see a peak, there's a yeah. So everything we just analyze all the data over the tree, and you know it doesn't really matter exactly if we got it perfectly right exactly when the cell division occurred, because it's just a question of where you cut the cell, the two cells. Okay, so the point is that this actually gives us that function we really wanted to know. So here I'm plotting the mean of this, all the data, in terms of this gene regulation function. So this is the repressor concentration, and you'll notice it's in real units, and this is the rate of production of the target gene. And we did it for both the wild-type lambda PR promoter and for a mutant promoter that has a single point mutation in it, which weakens the affinity. And you can really see from one mutation a change in the affinity, which is quite significant. Okay, so what I'm plotting here, though, is the mean over all that data. So there's also a lot of variation superimposed on that, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But first, I want to tell you how we get these units. And that's basically just a little trick we noticed, which is that if you look at the fluorescence of a parent cell, and then you look at the fluorescence of its two daughter cells right after division. Yep. Mutation was in repressor binding site. That's right. Yep. Then, of course, if you look at each individual division event, you get one of these blue dots. So here, the x-axis is the amount of the repressor in the parent cell, and the y-axis is the error in the partition of that repressor to the two daughter cells. And this is, of course, it's random, right? They're all over the place. But if you average them, then you find that they go up on average like the square root of the amount in the initial cell. And in fact, what you would expect, but the simplest possible model you could imagine, is that each molecule flips a coin to decide which daughter cell to go into. That would give you a binomial distribution, which would be consistent with this kind of square root behavior. And so the nice thing here is that we're not so interested in the fact that it's a binomial distribution, except insofar as this fit actually allows us to calibrate the amount of fluorescence per molecule. Okay? In other words, the amount of fluorescent signal we get per repressor molecule, which is something that normally we couldn't do because we can't detect in the cell a single GFP molecule because the fluorescence is below the autofluorescence of the cell. So the cells are just have, for various reasons, have kind of a natural fluorescence anyway. And so you can only see things once they get above that. And so for GFP, a single molecule of GFP is way below what you would be able to detect. But here you can calibrate in terms of it anyway.
Which is nice.
Yes. So we actually tried to look at the whole distribution, whether it was consistent with binomial and so on. Yeah. Actually, I should say, though, as you go off the right edge of this graph, other things start to happen. And this stops being like a square root and becomes linear. And we attribute that to measurement errors and to other things that start to happen at very high repressor concentration. This, all sorts of things, weird things start to occur. Yeah, so the asymmetry of the division, so the point is that the cell actually does not divide itself perfectly in half. So it makes an error in where it puts the septum. And that type of error, you would expect to give you a linear behavior on this graph rather than the square root of behavior. And so that's another source of, So we don't distinguish between them. There is one rule that people have to distinguish between different daughters, which is called old pole, new pole. And the idea is that when a cell divides, it produces a new septum. And so when the daughter cell has one end that's kind of a newly formed pole and one end that's an old pole that was there before. And so you can use this over a tree to give like a binary string identification to every cell, old, old, new, 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 old, new, old, new, new, as it goes and divides, right? So the cells are not perfect. There's one way of identifying a potential asymmetry in the cells. And you can ask then, is anything correlated with that particular asymmetry that you can see? In something like yeast, it's obviously, it's much more obvious the difference between the two cells, one's small, one's big. And so.
One last question. Yeah.
Well, actually, we'd like to get someone who does the FCS to kind of... it would be interesting to correlate this with that. We have not done that. So, yeah. Well, it's basically like this. If you just take a cell, right, and then it divides, these two poles here are new, and these two are old. Now, in the next generation, this cell is going to grow and divide. And so this pole will be old, old. This would be old, new. This would be also old. This would be also old, new. And you would call this new, new. You'd have old, again, old, old. But then you'd have, anyway, new, old, so on. Yeah, so if you observe this over a very long time, you could have a binary string which would tell you, give you a... Yeah. So our program does that, actually, just for fun. Yeah. I think we can see on the order of, say, well, I can tell you, because basically the KD here is 55 molecules per cell, and that's just a little above what we can see in the wild-type promoter. So we can probably see like 40, 30, I'd say probably 35 around there as a threshold. But the idea is that actually we can get all the biochemical parameters from these graphs just by watching the movies. That's the nice thing. And in particular, the thing that we're always most interested in is in how sharply these repression functions turn off. Because if they're very sharp, you can get things like bistability oscillations and so on. And if they're very smooth, then things tend to be more homeostatic. And in fact, in this particular system, one of the reasons we chose it was because it was always known to have a lot of cooperativity in the promoter. And in fact, you can see that it has a very high Hill coefficient of 2.4. I don't know if you want to call it very high, but quite significant. And you can actually measure these KDs, so you can see exactly the shift in the binding affinity when you make one mutation in the operator site. And you can actually measure quantitatively the expression of from the promoter and so on. So the other thing I should mention is that here we've used this fluorescent repressor, but one of the nice things, if you think about it, you don't actually need to see the repressor in order to measure the cooperativity. If we used an invisible repressor, we would have also been able to infer the cooperativity. Is that obvious to everybody? So the reason is because it's just because of using this dilution idea, right? So the cooperativity, basically, you could infer if you knew how many generations, cell generations, it took to go from, say, 10% expression to 90% expression. You could infer what the cooperativity was, even though you were not looking at the repressor. And so one of the things to verify this that we did was we we pretended that we didn't see the repressor, and we asked how accurately we could infer the Hill coefficient. Of course, if you don't see the repressor, you can't get these KDs and, you know, absolute numbers. But you can still get this Hill coefficient even from an invisible repressor. So if that's something you want to know, you don't even have to mess up the repressor by putting the protein fusion on it. You can do it on its native, on the native repressor, which is nice. You just have to make sure it's turned off. That's right. Which is, you can tell, yeah. The cooperativity? Yeah. So here, I didn't say it, but the structure of the promoter we're looking at is that it has two operators, and you can have dimers of the lambda repressor bound to neighboring operators, and then there can be an interaction between those dimers. It's actually, in this case, not really a loop, I think, because they're much too close together to actually loop the DNA, but they do interact with each other at the protein-protein level. And so one thing that you can also do is you can say, let's just knock out only the cooperativity by making a mutation in the repressor, for example, that knocks out just this protein-protein interaction, and ask how that affects this. So here what we're seeing is a kind of combination of two effects. One is that you've changed the affinity for one of the operators, not the other one. And as a result, the occupancy of that operator is a little lower, and that also seems to affect the cooperativity. But it'd be nice to also disentangle how much of that cooperativity is coming from the protein-protein interactions. And how much is just coming. So you can also get effective cooperativity just from the fact that you have multiple operators, either of which is sufficient to inhibit expression, right? So just the fact that if A is bound or B is bound or both, that also gives you an some nonlinearity, even without protein-protein interaction. Yeah? Because of the error bar? Consistent with two. Yeah, I mean, that's what it's experiments. What can I say? Right. I mean, this is our best guess. I think this is different. I mean, I think, you know, 2.4 minus 0.3 is 2.1, and 1.7 plus 0.3 is 2. Sure, it could be, in the worst case. It's oops. What? Yeah. Well, the point is we don't believe that the Hill coefficient really describes the exact shape of the curve. We're just using it to parameterize the shape of the curve with three easy numbers. So I don't think it should be taken very literally, but it does turn out to match it pretty well. So it matches. I'm going to talk about the fluctuations in a second. And within and compared to the magnitude of fluctuations, the deviation of the Hill function from the mean repression function is negligible. So it doesn't matter. That doesn't have to be an integer, right? You can get nonlinearity from many sources, dimerization, neighboring operators that act combinatorially, or protein-protein interactions. All of these things can contribute to different extents, and it depends on the quantitative parameters. There's no simple rule that tells you just because I have a protein-protein interaction, the Hill coefficient is going to be 2. No, you still care about this number because this is the number that's going to tell you if things could be bistable, if they can oscillate, and so on. You still do care about that number. Yeah. I wouldn't call it crap. It's 2 plus. It's 2. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, see, okay, so this is a question of perspective. So, Right. So for many years, people have been focused on the molecular mechanism. You know, can you figure out the binding constant, blah, 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 and the protein-protein interactions, and they're doing in vitro measurements of okay, I would say I don't care about any of that stuff. Is what the consequence of what we care about is this perspective, because this tells you what the rate law is that's going to give you the rate of expression, and that's what you use to understand the behavior of a network. So from the network point of view, this is the right picture, and I don't really care so much about the underlying molecule. Yeah. I don't assume, I check. If it turned out to have some other shape, I wouldn't have used this function.
Right, so this would be the molecule shape.
Yeah.
But in principle, if you want to, you would have to check every time, right?
Sure. But I mean, this is the point, this is the first time we've looked at anything, right? And it turns out to be well described by a Hill function. Didn't have to be, it was. I mean, yeah. The protein folding time is between 5 and 10 minutes, probably about 5 minutes.
And it becomes fluorescent?
Yeah, so we measured that. That's different. That's organism dependent. So the folding time of GFP seems to be fastest in E. coli, which is good for us. It's much slower in other organisms.
So that's 10 plus or minus what
is what you can pull out in your I'm going to show you the time scale, the fluctuations, and I'll show you that the time resolution of our experiments is basically about 10 minutes. So we don't try to push it down to time scales faster than the folding time of GFP, because we think the GFP folding is basically low-pass filtering all the data anyway. So there's no point. Okay. All right, so now I just want to move to the fluctuations. So, of course, this is those perfectly smooth curves are not what we really see. What we're really seeing is something like this, where you get dots all over the place. And what we wanted to do is try and see if we could decompose these fluctuations into their different components. Okay. So the first thing we noticed is that we could see DNA replication. So here I'm plotting on the y-axis the rate of production from this promoter, okay, the molecules produced per minute per cell, and as a function of the repressor concentration. So this is that the linear scale now instead of a log scale. That's why the data looks different. You can see all the scatter. And you can see that if I take points in time that are what we call newborn, right after division, and compare them to ones that are right before division, you can see there's a systematic difference. And if I take the ones right after, the mother cells, what did I say? Before division is the mother cell, right, about to divide. And I divide those by 2, then these things superimpose. So you see that? Okay? So the idea is that this is simply explained by just the doubling of the chromosome over the cell cycle. Okay? And what we can do is we can actually try to correct for that. We can't correct for it perfectly, but we can take out a lot of that variation by essentially assigning a copy number proportional to the cell cycle phase, even though copy number really changes discretely. It was hard to find one point in the cell cycle that seemed to be exactly the replication point for all the cells. Okay? So we can remove a lot of this variation. But we still have lots of fluctuations, so it's not just the cell cycle. Yeah. Well, I'll show you later. We actually do 2 independent measurements also in this case. Yeah. Okay, so then the next thing we looked at was, that was sort of about the amplitude of the fluctuations and its cell cycle dependence. Then we tried also to look at what's the distribution of the fluctuations. And here you can see that actually they look fairly log normal. What I mean by that is that if you try and fit it to a log normal distribution, you get a much better fit than if you fit it, say, to a normal distribution. And the reason that that's interesting is because you have something log normal, it suggests that it's consistent at least with lots of independently fluctuating variables that are affecting your process multiplicatively. Okay. So that's the next fact I want to mention. The third fact I want to mention is that if you look at individual cells along this graph over time, you find that they tend to fluctuate very slowly around the mean behavior. So for example, here's one cell lineage and you see it kind of slowly goes up and down. That's very typical here. This one goes below the curve for a long time. So the fluctuations around this mean are slow, and that's we can only see because we're doing movies here. Okay? And to make that precise, we looked at the autocorrelation function. So this decays exponentially with a time scale that depends on the typical time scale of fluctuation. And you can fit this basically to an exponential decrease with a time scale of about 45 minutes, which in these conditions is the cell cycle time. So what we have here is this is an autocorrelation of the production rate, the rate of production from the promoter. So the rate of production is fluctuating on a cell cycle time scale. And One reason you might expect something like that is because if the transcription, if the factors that are affecting expression are themselves stable proteins, they can only change over a cell cycle timescale because they can only change by dilution. And so if the rate of production from our promoter is affected by the level of the concentration of these stable proteins, which are themselves fluctuating over a cell cycle timescale, this is the type of behavior you might expect. Okay, now you can ask, I wrote the word extrinsic here, but you can ask, where is this coming from? Because this is, like you said, this is just one output. And so we made a variant of this strain where we knocked out the fluorescent repressor and replaced it with a second copy of the output to ask how much of this was coming from intrinsic versus extrinsic, just like in the first half of the talk. And if you look at the intrinsic noise, you find that its autocorrelation function decays much faster. With a timescale that's about 9 minutes, which, like we said before, is really limited probably by the folding time of the GFP. So even if it was much faster than that, we wouldn't be able to see it anyway. So what this says is that these two kinds of noise, intrinsic and extrinsic, fluctuate on totally different timescales under these conditions. Intrinsic noise decays rapidly. Extrinsic noise is very slow. That's the main point. And so altogether, we've identified now several different sources of fluctuation in the output. I just wanted to go through them to make it clear. So the first thing we see is this DNA replication, which you can think of schematically like this, right? The chromosome number doubles over the cell cycle, goes back. It's kind of a limit cycle, basically. I don't know why we have these little dips here. Okay. This is periodic. It's slow with a timescale of about the cell cycle. But because it's based on the cell cycle phase, in principle, you could imagine that the cell actually knows its own cell cycle phase. It could compensate for this in principle. I mean, I don't know a particular mechanism. So that's one source of variation. A second source of variation is this extrinsic noise. And here we have something that's not periodic, really. It fluctuates slowly. It also has a timescale of a cell cycle. But because it's aperiodic, it's hard to imagine that this cell necessarily has a direct measure built in of the activity here, although it could. Now, the other source, finally, at the end I mentioned, is the intrinsic noise in the output. This is also aperiodic, but it fluctuates very fast at a timescale probably less than about 9 minutes. Okay. So the main point I want to get across is that if you look at the relative magnitudes of these things, the extrinsic noise is the biggest effect in amplitude. And so this is kind of the dominant thing that's causing variation in the output of your promoter. So from the point of view of accurately relaying a signal using this repression curve, normally what you would have to do to get rid of these fluctuations would be to integrate over a timescale longer than the fluctuation. But here, because these fluctuations are very slow, they have a timescale about a cell cycle, in order to do that, in order to make an accurate have your output accurately reflect the level of the repressor in the cell, you would have to wait many cell cycles, which is a very long time if you're trying to respond to some signal. The idea is that this actually represents a kind of limit on how rapidly the cell can accurately transduce a intracellular signal represented by a repressor transcription factor concentration. So this seems to be kind of a fundamental limit here. No, the point is that for one repressor concentration, you want to use this function to accurately look up the rate of production of the target promoter, right? And the idea is that the whole function is basically fluctuating over the cell cycle timescale, right? So if you wanted to get, if you wanted to have your output reflect the mean sort of true underlying curve, you would be wrong, but you're, you know, you'd be just obeying your slowly fluctuating function. Following it. Yes.
That correlates with the repressor concentration that we measured, the slow variation?
Well, no, the repressor concentration is just being diluted out over the experiment, right?
Okay.
So the idea is that's just this parameter, and we're just using dilution to vary that parameter logarithmically. But then the output is side is fluctuating.
So this variation is something else. It's not repressor.
That's the right. So now, actually, it's a very important point you're making. So now extrinsic noise in this second half of the talk is different than extrinsic noise in the first half of the talk in two ways. The first way is that here we're talking about the rate of production by the promoter. So it's the activity of the promoter we're looking at as an output variable rather than the amount of protein produced by the promoter. The second way it's different is that Here we have measuring the repressor concentration. So we're removing actually the usually what's usually the most important extrinsic variable, and we're looking at all of the other extrinsic factors.
Okay.
Yeah, this is what's left over. It's a limitation on the repressor promoter thing, system as a functional modular unit. That's the point. That's right. No, that is absolutely correct. Yes. But that's the point. The point is that we're interested in how all of those other things that the cell is doing affect a particular modular system that we're interested in understanding, right? Because the idea is we want to be able to both model and build simple modular circuits that work inside the cell. And the environment that the cell presents is a fluctuating environment. And so what we're trying to do is separate the fluctuations in that environment from our system. That's the whole idea, separating these things. Right? So the point is that we're ignorant as to what exactly the cell is trying to do when it's making the polymerase concentration go all over the place. I don't know why it's doing it. Maybe we can learn, maybe future experiments. But we want to know what that does to the system we're looking at. Okay? That's kind of a philosophical thing. Ultimately, I think we're left with about 40% at the end, which is controlled by this. Yeah, that's okay, so let me just sum it all up. This sums up kind of the second half of the talk. So, first of all, one of the things that's always been limited in modeling gene regulation networks is that we never know what the parameters are. So every time you try and model a real system, I think anybody who's tried to do that will realize that you start immediately say, "Oh God, what are we going to put in for the parameters?" We've been doing this in my lab just last week a lot, you know, you don't really know. And here, the first idea is that we can actually just, using these movies, get these parameters quantitatively out of individual cells, okay, in a very non-invasive way. So it's not the case that we always have to guess. We can actually see what they are. Okay. And the fact that you can do it actually without, in a fairly easy way is also nice from a physicist's point of view. Okay. The second important point I wanted to make is that these dominant source of fluctuations are slow, cell cycle timescale, and they're extrinsic. They're not due to the process of gene expression itself. They're upstream of that process. Okay. And the reason that's important is that if you're modeling a network, the intrinsic noise arises naturally if you just simulate your model with like a Monte Carlo simulation. The intrinsic noise takes care of itself in some sense if your parameters are right. The extrinsic noise is something that comes from outside of your network, and it's something that you could not know about unless you directly measured it. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, the idea is we have a statistical character. No, the idea is we can, if we put in the extrinsic noise, we can do it in a statistical sense, right? It's not deterministic. But we can say statistically what the effect of the rest of the cell is on our system. We can do it. We can say the effect is, we can say we have a stochastic process that has a cell cycle correlation time that has a log normal distribution, right? Kind of like an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process in physics, except with the log normal instead of a normal distribution. So we can give it we can encapsulate all that variation into a very concise description. That's the point. Okay. And then we make this point about the fact that this type of noise is something that you can't integrate out. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to thank a few people. So the first part of the talk was a collaboration with Peter Swain and also with Eric Sigia and Arnie Levine at Rockefeller. The second part of the talk was done with Nitzan Rosenfeld, who's in Uri Alon's lab at Weizmann. And the movies actually were taken in my lab by Jonathan Young. And Peter Swain was also a major contributor to that work. And anyway, happy to take further questions. Okay, so the question basically is, what are the correlations among different promoters? So you can imagine two extreme models. One is that everything in the cell is fluctuating together in a kind of coherent mode, and the other is that everything's fluctuating kind of independently.
Yeah.
That's the question. Yeah, and so that's something we're looking at right now to answer that question. I think that's very important. Yeah. Redefine it? Oh, okay, so intrinsic noise in the expression of a gene is basically, we define it operationally, anything that would cause two copies of that gene to become uncorrelated. So, for example, events like binding of a polymerase, binding of a ribosome, degradation by a protease of the protein, anything that would act independently on each copy of the gene. That's the idea. And when we do it with rate, again, we just switch from protein amount to rate, but it's the same exact idea. Is that not clear? So, for example, it's differentiated from something like a fluctuation in the level of a transcription factor, which might affect all of its target genes the same way. If I suddenly double the transcription factor concentration, I will increase the expression of both two copies of the target gene on average the same. Right? But if I have an event like binding of a polymerase to one gene, that's independent of what's happening with the other gene. And so that's intrinsic.
So do you think that the fact that your extrinsic noise is
no, we don't think it's a coincidence. So the simple explanation for that is that the rates of production are dependent on the levels of stable proteins in the cell. Those stable proteins, like polymerases, ribosomes, etc., are maybe produced in a noisy fashion, but their amounts are basically low-pass filtered by the cell cycle. Because if you're producing something in a noisy way, but you're degrading it only by dilution, in other words, there's no degradation, just dilution, dilution sets the time scale for fluctuation, okay, because it's the slowest process. And so the idea is that you have all of these. In fact, I tried to make a slide of this, which I wisely avoided before, but maybe I'll try. So this was the idea here, is that all of these things, polymerases, ribosomes, transcription factors, they all impact the expression of any particular gene, including themselves. Okay? They may fluctuate rapidly in their production, but the cell cycle acts as a low-pass filter that leaves you with just a cell cycle timescale, leaves only the cell cycle timescale fluctuations around. And those then combine, right, to affect the expression of your test gene. And the log normal distribution is suggestive of kind of a multiplicative effect where polymerases, ribosomes, transcription factors all combine multiplicatively and to affect the expression of your gene. And then, of course, your gene is no different than the gene for the polymerase itself, right? I mean, it is different, but in principle, it could be the same. And so there's a kind of a feedback loop here where fluctuations in all of these components, which are independent, get cell cycle filtered, combine to affect their own expression and the expression of other genes in the cell. But this is the picture that we have in mind, and this is why we think that cell cycle timescale is a natural timescale on which the extrinsic noise should fluctuate. So we're trying to make this a little more precise, mathematically. Because it takes the time scale, for example, to multiply transcription translation, you're saying it takes the time scale of transcription plus the time scale of translation.
So yeah. That multiplication probably is also acting on the time scale of the cell cycle.
Well, no, that would be on the time scale, I think, of the degradation rate of mRNA, right? Some sense. No? That's right. It assumes that, but maybe not. Maybe not. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So the question is, if you have something like senescence, right, what would senescence, so if E. coli were really asymmetric, and maybe they are, and we had something like the bunny and yeast situation, and you had senescence of the mother cell, which goes on in yeast, then what you're saying is basically that you would have a systematic effect where the old mothers would get maybe slower and slower, or weaker and weaker expression, whereas the daughters would be different, right? And, yeah, which, and you would see it. Right. So has anybody in fission yeast ever seen systematic asymmetry with the old pole, new pole, or is that? Is there senescence in fission yeast? Or? In fission? Really? Oh, from Gotchling? He said yes. There's. I was wondering about that. Yeah.
So we asked about asymmetry. That's why I know about the fact that the way you place the here.
Yeah.
That there are holes that grow and holes that don't.
But in yeast, the holes are much more complicated, and so they could be carrying a lot of information into
your. Right. But if you look at the. Right. But I think the point is, like, when Erin looks at budding yeast and she's taking a snapshot of the population, like we did the first half of this talk, then she's seen cells in principle of different ages, although I guess half of them were just produced in the last generation. But in principle, some of them are older, and that, if you look at your extrinsic noise, some of that might be due to senescence, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, that's right, because you systematic aging, basically. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You haven't stated to say what the variability is in the different times and things like that?
Yes.
So, one, you might think that a global variable also affects how long things take to divide.
Yes. Okay, so if you look at the trees, basically, and you sort them by old pole, new pole, so our program actually automatically sorts everything from left to right and old pole, new pole, you may sometimes convince yourself that you see some systematic effect. This is actually very interesting. So if we look at the instantaneous rate of growth of the cell, it is correlated also with the instantaneous rate of expression. That is true. Yes, that's actually a good point. Yeah. This morning. Ah. Okay. Cool. Was this that old E. coli poles? Ah, this is a Radman's lab. Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah. Well, if it's much longer than our experiment, we wouldn't see it. But if it's longer than, if it's like two cell cycles, we would see it. I mean, we're looking to basically over about, say, 6 to 7 times cell cycles. So that's we can't see anything beyond, you know, a couple cell cycles reliably, really, 2, 3 maybe.
I mean, I really thought it was very surprising that after the cell cycle,
Yeah. Well, I should also say that this whole thing is a steady state picture, right? You take the Bacillus subtilis movie I showed you at the beginning, you starve the cells, all of a sudden, a lot of this doesn't apply really, right? Because suddenly you have discrete responses that are totally, right? Your cell cycle stops, you know. This what we're talking about in this part here really is the case of steady state growth. And these are the fluctuations that affect the most. The point of steady state growth is it's the most constant thing you can do, right? And the idea is this is the variability that's present when things are constant. Now, when things are varying, there's even more variability, and it's much more interesting. But this is kind of like the baseline. This is zero variation, basically, for a cell. Okay, thanks.